You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
My name is Rob Berkley. I'm director of the Runnymede Trust. I'm one of the organisations that's come together to put on this event, along with Maitrey, Barrow Cadbury Trust, and the Open Society Foundations. Without further ado, I want to hand over to Simon Woolley, who's director of Operation Black Vote, for the welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. Actually, I have the impossible task of replacing the irreplaceable. I'm replacing Nazia Hussain, who is the director of At Home in Europe here at the Open Society Foundation. My role here with the foundation is the chair of At Home in Europe, and we want to warmly welcome you to our establishment, to our premises, and to this program, which we think is vitally important. We are very happy to be partners, but not least because we think that working together is best. It ensures that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. We learn from each other, we support each other, and we achieve a great deal more together. As you can see, we've got a great array of very, very qualified speakers. I'm sure Rob will introduce you, but I'm now going to hand over to the chair of Metro.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. My name is Alan Broadbent. I am the chair of Metro, and I want to join in the welcome today on behalf of my colleagues at Metro. Maitrey is a Canadian foundation, and building inclusive communities is really at the heart of our work and has been for the last three decades. Our work started with anti-poverty initiatives, an issue that still lies at the heart of our mission. But in a city like Toronto, which is characterized as is London by hyper-diversity, almost any issue ends up being engaged with diversity and inclusion. Our urban region in Toronto is about 50% foreign-born and about 50% visible minority. So it's with particular pleasure for us today to join with you in taking this work forward. I want to talk a little briefly about the approach that we take to our work at Maitrey. We aren't a very big foundation by Canadian standards and certainly not by UK standards. We fund the work of Maitrey from our businesses at Avana Capital Corporation, which runs out of the same office as Maitrey. And we have a saying that we make the money in the morning and we give it away in the afternoon. So we know we have to be practical and efficient at Maitrey, and we do that in a number of ways. First, we're solution-seeking. That may sound very obvious, but we found that many organizations spend most of their time in what I call the culture of complaint. They spend their time describing problems and assigning blame. To us, that's a very expensive occupation. Of course, it is important to define problems so we know what we're dealing with, but in our view, more important to design solutions and to implement. Secondly, we value evidence. That again may sound obvious, but in Canada today, our national government is bent on eliminating vital data sources at Statistics Canada and other agencies, a process our partner organization, the Caledon Institute of Social Policy, has termed data-side. Recently, even the New York Times called out our Prime Minister for his aggressive anti-evidence activities. Third, we recognize that cities are the modern laboratories of change, and that making our cities work for everyone is critical. And fourth, we employ an approach we call relentless incrementalism. Incrementalism is our nod to the difficulty of dramatic change and that our systems are best geared to achieving the next achievable step. The telling word is relentless, which signals that once we reach that next achievable step, we'll press on for the next and the next one after that. Relentless incrementalism helps insulate us from magical thinking or waiting for a miraculous alignment of external forces. There are three lessons we've learned from our work in diversity and inclusion. The first is that nations have choices to make about how they treat immigrants. They can treat them as liabilities or assets. If they treat them as liabilities, they'll attempt to put limits around them and constrain the effect they have on society. They'll limit their employment opportunities, their ability to participate in the life of the community, and their prospects of becoming contributing citizens. If, on the other hand, they treat them as assets, they'll invest in them, like a smart business person will invest in a promising venture. They'll do whatever they can to make the immigrant succeed. They'll help them find the jobs for which they have experience and training. They'll help them settle securely in a neighborhood. They'll support their kids in school, and they'll accelerate their becoming contributing members of the community. They'll realize that nobody wins when immigrants don't succeed. So the choice in our mind is a simple one. Will we give immigrants shackles, or will we give them wings? The second lesson we've learned is about what we call the three I's: intentionality, instruments, and investments. Giving immigrants wings is being intentional about immigrant success and building inclusive communities. It is about intending to create success at work, home, and in the community and neighborhood, and as citizens. Instruments is about creating the effective mechanisms to give those intentions traction. It is through the design of instruments that we go beyond mere aspiration. And here are some examples from Toronto. The Toronto Region Immigrant Employment Council, a Matri initiative, developed two instruments for integrating skilled immigrants into the labor market. The first was a mentoring program that pairs an immigrant with a Canadian in a job-appropriate way, so a civil engineer with a civil engineer or a pharmacist with a pharmacist, both to communicate job culture but also to involve the immigrant in the Canadian's network of affiliation, a critical asset in job search. And the second instrument is a human resource practice for corporations so they can gain a competitive edge in engaging immigrant talent. Other instruments by other organizations include the Toronto District School Board, which uses the instrument of a student census to find out who comprises the student population, what they and their families want and value, so they can design proper and effective responses. They combine the census with two other instruments, the Faith and Community Walks, where teachers go into the community to meet families where they congregate, in community centers, high streets, and places of worship. The Toronto Police Service has developed an instrument to recruit police officers from diverse communities in order to be more effective in serving those communities. They dropped outdated height, weight, and appearance requirements in order to include a more representative group of officers, which has helped in both building trust in communities and in dealing with crime. And the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, our public broadcaster, deliberately set out changing the radio offerings at Toronto to appeal to the diverse community. They changed who their hosts were, what was talked about, and who was interviewed. And the results have been high ratings and increased credibility. In our view, instruments are critically important, and they're one of the things that are the most often neglected in trying to achieve our aspirations. And the final I, investment. Of course, financial investment will drive success, but so will investing political will by our leaders, and so will all of us investing our energy, hopefully relentlessly. And the third lesson we've learned is somewhat more sobering, that is that we won't treat newcomers any better than we treat each other. If in our societies we're divided on class, race, or gender, if we tolerate low wages and bad work, bad housing or transit deserts, if we tolerate voteless ghettos, we won't treat newcomers any better. Because after all, immigrants only really desire what we all desire: to be part of a fair and functioning community. I think we'll all take our chances with that. In Canada, we have a problem with how we treat our Aboriginal communities. We have issues with income distribution. As we work to make immigrant settlement and inclusion work, we also need to deal with these long-standing national issues in order to dramatically raise the floor for all of us. I won't presume to identify for you the issues in your country, but I'm sure you can all identify them yourselves. I will end with a more cheerful note, and that is our Cities of Migration project, because I think this is a wonderfully optimistic opportunity for us all. I talked earlier about how we reject the culture of complaint. Well, Cities of Migration is exactly the opposite. It's about catching people doing something right, which I find a very refreshing approach. Much of our work in Maitri is based in our belief in the power of communities to find solutions to the issues they face. We have faith in their self-knowledge and their determination, but sometimes they need a nudge or a hint, and Cities of Migration is exactly those things. It's a sharing of good practice and hooking people up so good ideas can travel. Indeed, those good ideas can take wing. So I'm very much looking forward to the rest of the afternoon and the panel discussion, because I think we'll hear a lot of those wonderful examples of good practice. So thank you very much.
So thanks very much, Alan. So the format for this afternoon is that we'll have a speech from Jonathan Porters, followed by some responses from the panel, and then there's an opportunity for the audience to ask questions but also give their views as well. So we're very lucky to have Jonathan with us. Jonathan's director of NISA, the grandfather of independent research facilities in the UK. Jonathan's got a long and successful track record of working in politics and economics, and was previously chief economist at the Cabinet Office, advising Cabinet Secretary Gus O'Donnell, and worked in 10 Downing Street. So, Jonathan.
Thanks very much, Rob, for inviting me and to others. I do feel here slightly under false pretenses, because looking, and I said this to Florence and Rob when I was invited, since looking at the title, Practical and Local Initiatives to Promote Migrant Integration, well, I'm an economist who's worked a lot on immigration. I know something about integration at a theoretical level, but I know absolutely nothing at the practical level that most people in this room work at. And when Alan says that we'll hear some great examples about practical initiatives to promote integration at a local level, I'm sure you will, but you won't be hearing them from me, because that's not something I know anything about. So, I will talk about what I know about and hope that is some useful context. What do I know about? I know about what the economic and social science evidence tells us about immigration, and to some extent a rather more complex and multidisciplinary subject of integration in the UK, particularly over the last 15 years. So I will start by outlining, I think the way I'll try and talk about this is start about outlining some of what we know, what we think we know, what the evidence says, what the consensus is among researchers, say a bit about what the public perceptions and political perceptions are around some of those issues and why or how those may differ from reality, and then without pretending to have any great expertise or answers, since I'm not a communication specialist either, but I'll say a bit about how one might think about addressing the disjuncture between perception and reality around some of these issues, and what local actions might contribute to that without, as I said, trying to say what I think those local actions are, since that isn't something I know a great deal about. I should say, since Barrow Cadbury are one of the sponsors here, that some of this work is building on research that we are doing that has been funded by Barrow Cadbury, and also the dissemination of which has been funded by Unbound Philanthropy and the Changing Minds program, which again many people in this room will be familiar with, and we at NISA are grateful for that, and we do see ourselves as having a role not in either advocating particular political solutions nor in implementing local initiatives, but in trying to get from where we are now to a somewhat more informed public debate on some of those issues. So, what do we know after 15 years? So, I mean, it is, you know, I do tend to send these things with a little bit of reminiscence. I started thinking about immigration when I was working in the number 10 policy unit, or strategy unit, back in 1999, when it first became apparent, two things became apparent. First of all, that there was a sudden and unexpected upsurge in levels of immigration to the UK, which largely went below the radar at that point. And second, that there was absolutely nobody in government who'd done the slightest bit of serious thinking or analysis about what this meant for the economic and social landscape of the UK. And moreover, because government had, as a deliberate matter of policy, not been interested in the economic and social impact of immigration in the UK for the previous 20 years, there was almost no one in the research community doing any work on this either. So we kicked off a program of research within government, and which later spread outside government on some of the economic and social impacts. And so we do know rather a lot more. Of course, a lot has happened since then. And in particular, what we predicted then at the time in the paper that I wrote then, which was that this would not be a flash in the pan, but that there would be a sustained, very large immigration to the UK for reasons to do with both domestic and international economic developments. This was something that was going to happen, would by and large be economically beneficial, and that the government should try and work with, but try and manage rather than ignore. All of these things did indeed come to pass, and we do know rather a lot more than we did then. So what do we know? Well, we know that the most research and most knowledge is about the labour market impacts of immigration. And we know that these are certainly surprisingly to me as a labour market economist, that these are surprisingly small as regards to the native population. There is been quite a large number of studies on the impact of immigration on unemployment for natives, and they've basically all failed to find anything, which really is quite a surprise to those of us who thought that there would be at least some transitory impact, and we were wrong. The British labour market has adapted remarkably well to a very large inflow of immigrants. There is probably some rather small negative impact on workers' wages at the lower end of the income distribution, but this really is pretty small, and it's dwarfed by a number of other things, positive and negative, going on at the same time. In particular, globalization, the impact of trade, the impact of technological change, the impact of the introduction of the national minimum wage, and so on. Public services. Again, I think the surprising thing here is how well, on the whole, UK public services have adapted to quite large population changes. It's been significant in some areas, but generally rather exaggerated. And on the whole, local authorities have quite reasonably complained very loudly about not having enough money and not being, the government figures being outdated and inaccurate, and they're usually right about that, at least to some extent. But on the whole, public services have adapted quite well, the impacts have generally been, pessimism has been rather exaggerated. We know certainly what the impact has been on the benefit system, which is very small. Immigrants on the whole are much less likely than natives to claim benefits. So overall, the fiscal, as a consequence, the overall fiscal impact, the impact on taxes, the public finances in general, is pretty clearly positive. And we've known for some time that was true in the short run. It follows pretty directly from the fact that immigrants are, on the whole, younger and healthier because they're younger, and with more recent immigrants more likely to be in work than natives. As a consequence, they're inevitably net contributors in the short run. Recent fiscal sustainability report published by the Office of Budget Responsibility, though, tells us something we didn't know, which is about the impact on the public finances in the long run, and showed, again, somewhat to my surprise, that this positive impact is likely to be sustained for a very long period, that as far ahead as the OBR look, which is half a century to 2060, we still see immigration having quite a significant beneficial impact on the public finances. I do always say that does not mean one should jump to the conclusion that we need immigration to pay our pensions, or we need immigration because otherwise there's a demographic train wreck hitting us. That is an exaggeration. Immigration is beneficial to the public finances, and one should push back against people who say it may be okay for the short run, but we're storing up long-run problems. That is not true. But equally, it's not true that immigration is a panacea for adjusting to demographic change. One way or another, the country will have to adjust to demographic change, whether or not immigration is the case. So then, however, is the public perception? Well, the public perception is rather the opposite of all this. The public perception has demonstrated not only by what the political parties say, and I think we have to recognize that the parties are following public opinion rather than leading it for the most part in this, and that even the tabloid press, exaggerated as it may be, is probably following public opinion to a large extent rather than leading it. They think that immigrants are responsible for the public perception is certainly that immigrants are responsible for increasing unemployment, that they're not a disproportionate burden on the system, and so on. So we know that. So what is the the responses to that? Well, my response from an evidence point of view tends to be, at a very high level, the following, which is that this country has some very serious structural problems which predated the recession in education, the skill system, and the labor market. Those problems relate to a very large extent to the fact that we do not have a very good system for helping succeed in the labor market, those people who do not go to university. The 50% of kids who do not go into university are not very well served in later stages of compulsory education, in the transition to the labor market, or if they become unemployed in getting back into the labor market. Blaming immigration for this has very little evidential support. Well, that statement in itself doesn't convince anybody. What I think is more effective is to point very clearly at those areas. We know the areas where these problems are worse. We know there are, for example, 8 local authorities in the country where fewer than half of kids who speak English as a first language, in other words, non-EAL kids, native English speakers, as it were, where fewer than 50% get 5 good GCSEs, including English and maths. Those local authorities are Blackpool, Knowsley, Barnsley, Hartlepool, Nottingham, Middlesbrough, Hull, and, slightly ironically, the Isle of Wight. Of those, the Isle of Wight matters, actually, because it's emblematic of a more general problem, which is actually often the places in the country where poor kids, especially poor white or poor working class kids, do worse, are areas that actually appear to be relatively prosperous in some respects. That's not true of the other places on these that I've just mentioned, which are mostly generally depressed. But the key point here, obviously, is that others, only Nottingham has a very substantial immigrant population. The others have generally low levels of immigration. And in the case of Knowsley, for example, Knowsley has about the highest level of people who were born in this country, in the country, more than 98%. And Knowsley has probably the worst education outcomes and the worst labor market in the country as well. So I do think, there is, at a very basic level, the story doesn't add up. And similarly, the immigration story doesn't add up in London. About 52% of kids on free school meals get 5 good GCSEs. In the southwest of the country, not a poor area, and not, on the whole, an immigration-heavy area, only 30% of kids on free school meals get 5 good GCSEs. So we know that geographically this story doesn't add up. But that in itself doesn't... I think that in itself, people find it difficult to argue with that one head on. So for me, that is the starting point in this discussion of saying, well, why shouldn't we blame immigration for these problems? Why do I feel quite confident, even when, though I don't like to make directly political statements, to say that politicians who blame immigration for the problems of the education system, problems of youth unemployment, are scapegoating, and I use that word advisedly. I don't use it to refer to people who are being, as a code for saying you're a racist. People, politicians who scapegoat immigrants or immigration for these problems are not necessarily racist, but they are using immigration as a scapegoat for problems which they are failing to tackle themselves, problems which are more deep-rooted. And I think that is the first important to make. Right? The second important to make is the optimistic one, and I would transition then off that. This is the experience of London in one very particular area, which is education over the last 10 years. And this is something which I think we should talk a lot more about. That is not as generally recognized in the policy debate as it should be by a long way. So London is now, as far as I know, the only capital city in the world where kids outperform the country as a whole. That is actually, some of the numbers on this are actually quite astonishing. You see kids on free school meals in some boroughs in London performing at the national average. There is nowhere else in the country that comes remotely close to that. London schools have gone from being roughly average 10 or 12 years ago to being far ahead, particularly for poor kids, in closing the achievement gap and overall achievement. That is quite an astonishing achievement. For anyone who hasn't read various articles, both data heavy and more anecdotal, by Chris Cook, the Financial Times education correspondent, I do highly recommend them. This is a remarkable achievement. And this, I think, is then where you come on to the positive thing. What is it that we could do that would actually address some of these deep-rooted problems, and in doing so, allay some of the concerns that people around the country legitimately have over the prospects, particularly of young people, particularly of unskilled thing. And the simple thing is replicate what is London has done, what has been done in London, by a combination of political will, both national political will and local political will, leadership within schools, refusal to accept second best for our kids, replicate that in Knowsley, Hull, Hartlepool and the Isle of Wight. If we did that, I think a lot of these concerns would drop away. And so on that optimistic note, I will finish. Cool. There's a lot more I could say.
And Jonathan will stay with us on the panel, so there'll be an opportunity to ask questions and to follow up later on. I should introduce the rest of our panel. So, to my left, never mind my left and my right, it's a long-term story, long-term problem, is Dan Silver, who's Director of the Social Action and Research Foundation. Next to him is Andrew Boff, who's a London Assembly member, and has been a councillor in Hillingdon and Hackney. Next to Andrew is Cynthia Masiyiwa from Active Horizons. Cynthia, I last saw winning an award. That's right, isn't it? So Cynthia, a young migrant woman of the Migrant Woman of the Year. Next, we have Ratna Amidvar, who is president of the Maitri Foundation. Jonathan, we've heard from already, and Councillor Karen Bellamy, who's Junior League Member for Child and Family Poverty at Waltham Forest Council. So, Dan, would you like to start?
One of the questions I was asked to think about before to talk about was the north-south divide. I thought I'd start with a quote from George Orwell. He said, "When you go north, you begin to encounter the real ugliness of industrialisation, an ugliness so frightful and so arresting that you're obliged to come to terms with it." And I thought, George Orwell's probably a bit wrong there, and things have changed a lot. Despite I think there's someone in the House of Lords who said the North was a very desolate place, which caused all sorts of anger. Well, I think the effects of deindustrialisation on the north have had a long-term impact. So a lot of the manufacturing jobs that left haven't come back. A lot of people find themselves in low-paid, insecure working services industries. And there's a lot of areas that are struggling despite quite a lot of investment from the new Labour government through neighbourhood renewal and all these different policies. And that's manifested in a range of different ways, so educational outcomes, with health inequalities. Someone from the north is 20% less likely to live to 75 than someone from the south, and that's the widest gap in 40 years, so it's getting worse. The government, when the government came in their spending review in 2010, financial settlements, the amount of money going to councils, 7 out of 10 of the worst hit areas were in the north. So Knowsley, I know for sure, was quite out there. And then when you take a lot of the northern cities and urban areas, London's like a totally different world. So the economic output of the financial sector in London is bigger than the output of the whole of the northeast. Apparently this is what I read. But then it becomes a bit more complicated because 3 out of the 10 worst affected local authorities are in London. So I think that paints a real picture that it's inequalities within cities. So we have the north-south divide and there's obvious things there, but it's inequalities within cities that are just as important. So describing areas in the north, areas struggling in the south, and I think part of this programme and the work we're doing is to look at the inequalities within cities. So even within the city of Manchester, the life expectancy can drop by 10 if you just go five miles up the road. So we've been working for, I should have said at the start, but we've been working with the Open Society Foundation's At Home in Europe project. So we're doing research on white working class communities in North Manchester, which has been absolutely fascinating, if sometimes a bit depressing, but with bits of hope at the end. So what we found there is quite resilient communities that are based on family connections, people in the community, that are managing to survive, sometimes thrive, despite there being economic uncertainty. People in a low pay, no pay cycle of where they're coming in and out of work, and even when they're in work, it's bad. Living standards are getting worse, health is getting worse, depression, mental health. The amount of suicide since the recession has gone up in Manchester quite significantly, apparently. So we found a lot of that. The things that are challenging it at the area in terms of migration is that you've got these really strong community support networks. So then when people see outsiders who they perceive as immigrants, although not everyone is an immigrant, even if they've lived for their whole life down the road, but they have a different skin colour, they're described as immigrants by most of the residents we spoke to, is that they see them threatening there's little that they have. So in terms of housing, if people are moving in and they see families getting evicted, that's really a motive for people. Jobs, all the sort of things that you would have heard a lot about, this really becomes more pronounced in areas of deprivation and when times are getting more hard. And I think the economic arguments and saying not much has changed, there's not been that much of an impact, wouldn't have much effect on some of the people we've been speaking to have got these fears. And I think when we've tried to challenge back through the research process, we've heard the term do-gooders come up several times. So they're like, I think we would class as do-gooders. I think most people here would be classed as do-gooders who don't live this life. They don't know what it's like. And if you say, well, it's good for the economy, then it's not good for that. People haven't seen an improved economy even during the boom years. So then when you say migration's good, then that really gets challenged, and yeah, do-gooders came up quite a lot. Also the sense that BME communities would use the race card, that this was a really strong thing. Oh, they get the housing because they play the race card, and even if you challenge this, it's just so strong within communities. And I think I've been working before as we set up the Social Action Research Foundation, working on race equality issues, so it's different to come from a totally different angle. And it has been quite eye-opening. In terms of solutions, to be quite quick, we think from the research we've been doing is looking around addressing wider grievances that people have. So addressing living standards, addressing housing issues, jobs, but secure jobs, because the thing that we've heard constantly, and it's come up quite a lot, is people say that they're not racist, they're just resentful. And I think that was quite strong. I think some people are a bit racist, and that they hide behind that, and I won't go into some of the stories yet, but I think to look at some of the wider social and economic issues as a pre-factor as a phrase, as a pre-issue before looking at integration, really. Yeah.
Thanks, Dave. Andrew.
Thanks, Sharon. I don't want to say much because I think you've said a lot of what I wanted to say. Certainly, if you're a London politician, you know that if we can't get it working here, we can't get it working anywhere in the world. It is the most diverse city in the world. Don't let anybody tell you any other city is, because it is London.
Manchester has more linguistic diversity than London.
Oh, well, in terms of total diversity, it can't be London. But you've got to realise the subtleties of the debate in London. I mean, the most... I've knocked on an awful lot of doors as a politician, and when I knocked on the door in Hoxton, when I heard the most the loudest criticism of immigration policies of my party and all the other parties about how we're letting them all in, we're giving them all their jobs, we're handing them the jobs, we're giving them the houses, and all said in the richest Jamaican accent you've ever heard in your life. So it's a lot more subtle, the prejudice that we have. Only the other day I heard of the criticisms of Polish immigrants coming from Asian, from effectively Hindu Indians, because actually we were part of the Commonwealth. They aren't. They were never part of the Commonwealth. We came over here to save your health service. They didn't. They just come over here and take an order. I've heard all this. And so it's much more complicated. And at some point, we're going to find a politician who is brave enough to get up on a public soapbox and say that the criticisms of immigration are bullshit. Because they are. They are absolute rubbish. They are not based in fact. Sometimes it's not who you know or what you know, but how you know. How do people come to the conclusion that all their homes have been taken by immigrants? How did they get that information? It's because there's so many people around willing to peddle that information. I remember hearing so many accusations as a councillor, both in Hillingdon and in Hackney, about such and such got it because they were... Hillingdon, it was typically because they were Sikhs or because they were Hindus or whatever they got house because of. In Hackney, it was because they were Turkish or because they were black or all the rest of it. And I did research on all of these ones. And in no cases I've ever heard of has there ever, ever been a race bias. I haven't seen it, and I have seen no evidence ever of it. And therefore, I've got to conclude that it is, as I said, bullshit. But unfortunately, nobody will say this. Nobody will stand up and say this. Now, in London, we have to engage with community. We have to do it, because otherwise we wouldn't survive as a city. I'm constantly surprised by the criticisms I hear of the way in which both London mayors and the local authorities in predecessor authorities, the Greater London Authority, The way in which London engages with migrant communities, we're told from the rest of the country, it's an awful mix in London, and we're all terribly depressed, we're terribly poor, and it's a real problem dealing with migration. Well, yes, it is a problem dealing with migration. But then again, if there'd been no migrants, over the past 20 years, if you look at the house building records of both flavours of government, we'd still have had a housing crisis. We'd still have had a housing crisis if there were no immigration, because the governments weren't building enough houses. So it's not good enough to say that the immigrants have got the houses. Somebody's got to challenge this and challenge it publicly. And unfortunately, politicians now, I think in every single party, seem to be going along this line. Fortunately, you have people who have common sense. I do actually think, that the Mayor of London has common sense on this issue. I think his predecessor was common sense on this issue. We accept the only change that Boris has brought about, particularly in London is there is a slight change of emphasis in the celebration of London's diversity. The slight change of emphasis is rather than, and this might sound not much to do, it's not so much the value of the culture you came from, which is about reinforcing the culture you came from. The emphasis now is about what you bring, what your culture brings to London. And we think that's a much more inclusive emphasis. It's not to say that the former was bad. It's a much more inclusive emphasis to say what everybody does bring to London, what we value it. And if that does mean holding celebrations, does mean the expenditure of money, it's all an expenditure of money to bring people on board. But I would, I'm sorry, I've gone on a bit too long. Just one second more. I would, first of all, say I've got to fire a warning shot about some things that have been happening recently. It's absolute truism that everybody should learn English. We know that. It would be so much easier if everybody learned English. And we all accept that. They're not going to. There are some people who are not going to English, or they're not going to learn it in the time frame that we want them to learn, that we want them to know it. Therefore, stunts such as in Newham, where the mayor of Newham has said that he is completely cutting back on translation services in Newham on the basis that that will foster more integration, is an extremely dangerous stunt. He's actually saying that people in abusive relationships, people who have been trafficked into the UK, people who are in need of public health advice, will not receive it in Newham because of an ideological statement about translation services and how everybody should speak English. It's a very dangerous step to take. And before we start making those public statements, and I hope other local authorities don't follow Newham's example, before we start doing it, we've got to really look at what the impact of what we're doing is, not on our consciences, not on our planning, but what it influence has on individuals in our communities in London. I've gone on much too long, and I am sorry.
No problem. Thank you, Andrew.
That's pretty good.
Cool. Okay, welcome to you next.
You can. One of the questions that I was asked was how is Waltham Forest taking a proactive approach to supporting immigration? As a local authority, we are sixth most deprived borough in London. We, at the last count across the country, we were 15th. We think at the next figures we're going to probably be between 11 and 9. So there are great levels of deprivation. There are also great areas where it's very affluent in our borough. However, in those areas, we've noticed over the past 3 years that they are creeping up in the indices of deprivation. Now you've got areas, and the area I'm talking about in particular is in Chingford, where some of the houses along Rangers Road and places like that are in the millions. It's mad. It's totally mad. But when we look at the indices, we see that there is pockets of deprivation there. And that is basically because we're getting houses of multiple occupation. So people are moving out and they're renting the houses out, and they are now becoming very, very dangerous places because you've got 2, 3, 4 families living in those houses and nobody really knows what's going on in there because they're in private renting. So that's one of the things that we're trying to do to support, because most of the people that are going into those houses are migrants. It's not the indigenous population, it is the migrant population, and they are being, I think, exploited by private landlords. So we're looking at our private landlord situation and going along the line of a licence to protect vulnerable people. As a borough, we do lots around diversity. We have a multi-faith group that basically goes around the borough, and they call them faith walks for peace, and they will go to all the different religious venues, temples, synagogues, mosques, churches, and this is a regular thing that we do, which is supported by the council. We've got our interfaith group, which is supported by Waltham Forest Council. We have, every year, we have a Mela. We have an Afro-Caribbean carnival, not as big as the Notting Hill Carnival, unfortunately, but we hope to get there one day. We do Sikh events, we go to temple, and we spend quite a lot of money on doing that. And we also give quite a lot of grants to community groups. However, going forward, the worry is that we have all been squeezed. You know, since 2010, we have lost in Waltham Forest 64 million. By the time we get to 2016, we estimate that our budget is going to be down by over 100 million. And it then becomes a really stark choice between where do we go with the money? Are we going to deliver frontline services, or are we going to support migrant groups and different ethnic groups? And are we going to support individual events? I don't know where we're going to go with that. Personally, I'm a child of migrant parents to this country, and although I don't look like that it would happen, I have experienced as a child racism, because I'm a child of Irish parents. And during the 60s, 1969, we had, you sworn, so I will, we had Irish bastards painted on our door and dog excrement put through the letterbox. So I have experienced it. No blacks, no Irish, no dogs. My parents experienced that. I think that at the moment we're in a pretty dangerous situation because there are a lot of people out there that are struggling, a lot of Indigenous people that are struggling, and as you say, they see people moving into houses and they think that there's some form of favouritism. When you knock on the door as a politician and they stand there and say, well, they got a house, why did they get a house? You gave them a house. No, it's actually a private rented house, and what you'll find is they are either paying rent or they are claiming some sort of benefit. Highly unlikely that they're going to get benefit, they're probably working together to pay the rent. And I think when we get into the situations that we're in at the moment, where services are being squeezed, jobs are being lost, it does get quite scary on the doorstep, because you just think, if you go back to the 30s and places like that, when people feel vulnerable, they need to look and find somebody to blame. And it's not usually the government, because they're too far away. They're going to look to whoever is closest and who may be different. And that's what I'm finding on the doorstep, and I think that's scary. However, having done some work with the Open Society Foundation around migrants in Europe, what we did in Waltham Forest was we went out and we talked to basically white working class population in my ward, which, as I said, is one of the deprived. We've done it across age groups, and we got varying degrees of feedback. We didn't experience too much racism, which, to be honest, surprised me. Then we went into the Asian community and did the same thing. And then the idea was to bring the two groups together and just to see what happens. I was quite nervous about that, because it could be quite a volatile situation, because it's like you haven't got, and you haven't got, but actually you might have more than me, and why is that? Because a lot of what we heard from the white working classes, they've all got, you know, the Asian community is full of people that have got big cars, big houses, they've got all the shops, they do this, they do that, and actually it's not the case. When we put the two groups together, what we found and was the similarities that they were experiencing on the ground, because it was poor Asian people and, as I said, white working class. It was an interesting project to be involved in, and I hope we can take it forward actually within Waltham Forest. And what we found was that when you bring people together, the differences fall away and actually the similarities come to the surface. And that's what we found working with the groups. And it was really, I found it quite heartwarming. We had a couple of women in the group, the white working class group, who I would never have said would have done this. We had a group of Asian women that do, they provide lunches and stuff during the day. And at the end of the project, two of our white working class women asked if they could go and volunteer at the Asian women's group to provide lunches for Asian elders. And that was just a joy. And I think that what we've got to do, instead of maybe doing different events, it's about bringing people together and letting people see that actually, although we are all different, there are huge similarities, and that's what I would hope for in the future.
Thanks a lot, Karen. Cynthia, what's your reflection?
Yeah, well, I'll sort of talk about my experience of being a migrant in this country. And I was just sitting on the computer today trying to find figures, you know, trying to look at what other people are doing. But then I thought, you know, what better way is there for me to talk about the positive contribution people like me make to this country than my actual story? So I came from Zimbabwe in 2005, and it wasn't my decision to come. I was 15 at that time. It was my parents who made the choice for me to come here. And when I moved here, I was in year 9. About 3 months after I started school, I lost my mom because I left my parents in Zimbabwe. And now this is me grieving, and I was the only black student in my class, and I faced a lot of racism. During sports time, instead of having a football, I became the football to everyone. And it was that hard. But it took one day when we had a speaking and listening exercise in class, and the question was, talk about anything. You can talk about your role model, talk about your pet, talk about your parents, anything you want to talk about. And at that time, I was quite shy and very insecure about my accent, because I had a very strong African accent. And I stood in front of the class and I told the class why I'd moved to the country, which is I was fleeing away from the political violence in Zimbabwe. And I told them that I was actually the Kent Championship for long jump, 100 meter sprinting. I was their captain for the volleyball team in Southeast London, for basketball team, all these things that I was contributing to, but none of them had a clear idea who I am. I opened up to them and told them, you know what, I want to be a doctor someday, even though I've changed a lot of times now. But then I wanted to be a doctor. And just trying to make them understand that I'm just the same as each one of them in that class. A young person just trying to pursue something, just trying to succeed and make something out of themselves. After that exercise, everybody came to me and said, you know what, Cynthia, we're really sorry for the way that we treated you. Now I asked them, so why did you guys treat me that way? Why did most of them didn't even know me. And there were responses about, some of them clearly just came from families that anybody that has got a different skin color is just a no-no. Some of them talked about what media says about us. Some of them, it was just, I'm copying what my friend does, because my friend doesn't like you. Yeah. I'm not gonna like you. But then since that day, you know, anybody that tried to do anything to me, my class was right behind me. They would say, don't even try to go anywhere near Cynthia. Now, after that, when I turned 18, my temporary immigration status expired and I could not go to university. I'd done well with my GCSEs, about 12 GCSEs, done my A-levels, could not go to university, could not get a job, could not do anything. Now at 18, that's when you're saying, now I'm a woman, I can do what I want, I can get married, do all these things, you know. But I couldn't do any of those things. Now, it can't, from that point, that is what made me want to get involved in community participation and act on the issues that affect me. I started to work on issues like racism, or even young people like myself that had achieved so much but couldn't have that access to higher education or couldn't go anywhere forward. Working with young people in my community, kind of making them realize that, you know, if you are affected by something or if you've got something wrong in your life, it starts with you, empowering them. Now, there are certain things that I couldn't have learned if I had not came to this country. I come from a background where women are not supposed to say anything. Even in church, you're not supposed to say anything. But then being in this country, understanding, you know, that we are all equal. Now, you can imagine if I was still in Zimbabwe, you can imagine what sort of person would I be? Because back then I was even shy. I would walk in this room and sit right at the back. But now I'm that person that is able to speak out. I'm able to succeed in anything because I believe I can do it. And this is something, I'm just trying to talk about the things that I've learned from this country as well. And even the opportunities in this country. And working with young people here in Africa, we believe about even a child can be raised by a community. working with young people in my community to actually make them realize that it's about us working together, whether you're from the mosque, you're from the church, whether you're from the temple, whether you, whoever you are, you can actually work together and achieve something. So now this is the last story, but just to end on a note about the importance of the community working together, I believe that we are taught that it's really important in life to focus on the positives about yourself as an individual. And I hope that even as a community, we'll work like that. Look at the positive contribution that the next person to you contributes. I'm not saying we should ignore the negatives, because there is negative. In real life, there is negatives. But the positives is what makes us be together and kind of realize the benefits about us integrating, us coming together as different communities. That's about it.
Thank you.
As I've listened to all of you, it's inevitable that I'm struck with what I see are the similarities and what I see as the differences. And as Jonathan was speaking, speaking on the basis of evidence, the evidence in Canada too, and I suspect in many other jurisdictions, is very similar. The impact of immigration on the economy, the labor market, the uptake on public services, the adaptation of public services, it's all relatively the same narrative. But where we differ significantly is on a few points, and I'd like to just sort of make those points before I go on to talking about some of the great points of light that we have discovered in local councils in the UK. So first of all, our demographic imperative is really evidence-based. We are a very large country with a population of 35 million people, and without immigration, we will fall into negative population growth by 2031. And this is sort of universally now accepted in Canada, that we need immigrants to grow our economy, to build our nation. The second difference, I think, and I observe this as I read your tabloid press, is that there is no politician who wants to get elected who will actually stand up and say anything negative about immigration, because the immigrant vote matters hugely in Canada. Our ruling party in Ottawa, Conservative Party, has flipped around its support from immigrant communities to actually gain a majority in Canada. And the third difference, I think, is one of public opinion. By and large, the majority of Canadians support the general construct of immigration, multiculturalism, call it what you may, and in polls on multiculturalism. Without quite understanding what it is, most Canadians, and I'll give you a rough figure, 67%, depending on the poll, 67% to a high of 80%, most Canadians will say multiculturalism is part of our identity, just the same way, you know, think of the other Canadian symbols, hockey, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, Wayne Gretzky, and multiculturalism. Pretty far up the line as a symbol of who Canada thinks it is. And again, I think the differences in how we address our issues, and of course we have them too, is also quite stark for me. In Canada, our biggest challenge is in ensuring that immigrants are successful within the first 10 years. And this gap in timing is growing. It's not contracting. And the work that Alan invests in, when he talks about relentless incrementalism, he has to understand he's making me relentless too. So we invest a lot of our resources in collapsing these expanding time frames of settlement and integration, because we believe, and this is, as I said, shared by many Canadians, that the success of immigrants is in fact the success of Canada, and one can't happen without the other. Here, it seems to me your bigger challenges are in the second and third generation. The whole issue of British identity seems to raise its head quite often. We, like you, we have used different strategies, which I don't personally agree with what our government is doing, in reducing inflows of refugees, let's say, from Eastern Europe. We've taken out advertisements too in Hungary, for instance, until we were stopped from doing so, to stop the inflow of Roma refugees to Canada. You use bus hoardings, I understand, in different. So we have similar challenges in different ways, and we use similar instruments as well. But I think the greatest difference in our two jurisdictions is that we think, you know, you've buried multiculturalism from what I can understand. You're actively looking for a new construct to help you figure out identity, social cohesion. You're quite by and large satisfied with the construct of multiculturalism, which doesn't mean that we won't look to what you're doing within. Alan spoke about cities of migration, and I just want to expand a little bit on that. And why do we do this? And when we started Cities of Migration, and when we consulted with our national and international partners, the challenge that was thrown to us was, you cannot speak about this in terms of replication and replicating good ideas, because national context is so very different. What works in Canada will not work in the United States, will not work in Germany. And we sort of defied that trend and went out actively finding, as Alan has said, points of light that can travel nimbly. And as you were speaking, Councillor, I was wanting very much to show you a good practice from Barcelona, which is called the Anti-Rumor Campaign. And the council, the city council in Barcelona, supports an anti-rumor campaign precisely to dispel the narrative, the negative narrative that you were talking about. And as we do our work, we found that national policies, national media, national sentiment, notwithstanding, cities can march to their own tune. And when we went out and looked in the last year at practices coming out from local governments in UK, Spain, Germany, Canada, the UK, the US, and New Zealand, we found some really interesting ideas from the UK as well, which we've documented in a special UK publication. And I'll just give you a taste of what we think you're doing at the local level that is worth shouting out about, so that Canada can learn from you, Canadian cities, US cities can learn from you. So in Cardiff, for instance, which has received in the last 10 years, I understand, a significant number of refugees, the police force has inserted itself as a language trainer in order to build trust. And 10 years later, their police force has much more trust from refugee communities, and refugee communities traditionally do not trust the police for obvious reasons. They've turned that around. And forgive me if I pronounce these not quite right. In Hertfordshire, how do I say it, Parth? Hertfordshire. Again, the police chief facing a significant influx of Polish immigrants into the council was informed that there wasn't any public space where the Polish immigrants could meet. And he offered up the local fire station. That would be illegal in Canada. We couldn't do that. So here's a story that couldn't travel. But here's the opportunity. He offered up a local public space as a convening ground for Polish immigrants, and so significantly amplified electoral participation. In Wolverhampton, again, if I'm pronouncing that correct, apparently a council made up of significant numbers of Indians, the local council reached to business connections in India through the common bonds of football and cricket. So much so that there is now a bank from India doing business and driving business in that community. So why do we do this? You know, I think someone said winning hearts and minds. I think, Jonathan, you did. Winning hearts and minds seems to be the biggest challenge on this file, regardless of where you are. And we do this in order to sort of replace those stories of fear and anxiety with stories of hope and success. And I leave you with some reflections on what we have found based on our work. firstly, that cities have more levers of instrument and power than maybe they give themselves credit for. And they have significant instruments which they can deploy in this file. Secondly, local mayoral voice matters a great deal. You spoke about Boris Johnson. We've heard about Ken Livingstone. I can tell you stories of how Rahm Emanuel in Chicago has significantly moved that jurisdiction, as has Mayor Bloomberg. Thirdly, that when cities act in concert with local NGOs and other public service institutions like school boards, like libraries, like the fire chief, like the police chief, they can amplify their impact many times over. And finally, this is a conclusion I make, that in cities like London, in cities like New York or Toronto, migration issues are universal issues. At dinner last night with Parath sitting here, he asked me a question, and I had to think about that. Which city, which major urban city is prosperous and does not have a significant presence of immigrants? And that's true. I thought about it. New York, London, Toronto, Miami, Houston, many other places. So we have to insert, we have to refrain from using migration as a silo issue and embed it vertically and horizontally into other local planning and, in fact, national policy conversations. So, stop.
Thank you. So we've got about 45 minutes to hear from the audience. Comments, questions. It strikes me that we've had a really broad range of issues raised. Jonathan talked about the gap between perception and reality. Dan talked about the context of inequality. And the nice phrase, not racist, but resentful. Andrew talked about political leadership and the bravery that will take politicians to engage. Karen talked about the dangers of exploitation, as well as the possibilities of building solidarity. Cynthia reminded us that migrants have a leadership role as well, and an important role in terms of leadership. And Ratna, a useful reminder again, that it doesn't have to be this way. It's as a result of the choices that we make. And also to rethink about the kind of units we talk about. We often talk about the nation, but it might be worth thinking about the city and the locality as well. Over to you. If you have a question, if you could introduce yourself, that would be helpful. If you are from a particular organisation, and if you've got a question for a particular speaker, say so. But if we're interested in your comments and your thoughts. There's a great deal of expertise in this room as well. So.
Hi, I'm Susie Symes, and I chair the Museums, Immigration and Diversity here in London, which is actually the first one ever to be founded in Europe. And I wanted to pick up on what you were saying about Walking Forest, actually, and the power of bringing communities together. I'd say communities, I'd also say groups, I'd also say individuals. You know, there's a danger in lumping all individuals together under the community word. But particularly wanted to pick up, given where I'm coming from, the role that cultural institutions have in encouraging both civic engagement and in being, if you like, safe spaces, almost politics-free spaces for people to come together. And I know that there's a lot of work of this kind that's gone on in various cities. I think of Pier 21 in Halifax in Canada, the Tenement Museum in New York, and of course us in Prinsep Street, who learned a lot in our case from the peace and reconciliation process in South Africa, the bringing together, or at least the attempts at bringing together Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland. That there's quite a lot of work, and there's far more that could be done by arts and cultural organisations, not by focusing on particular communities, but actually by providing these safe spaces for people to talk with each other, to engage with each other, and to engage with these common narratives. You know, the common narrative of migration and the histories of the places where we live.
Should we take a group of questions? Don, you had a...
Don Swain, Migrants Rights Network. I think possibly picking up on Susie's point, but developing a bit further, because it seems to me it's not just about having safe places to talk, but actually safe places to affect the balance of power in our local communities. And Alan made a very interesting point at the beginning when he talked about the power to bring about incremental change on a day-by-day basis, actually to see things getting better. And from where I stand, I think the problem is that that's actually been stripped away from us. We've still got our you know, occasional examples, and perhaps Cardiff and Wolverhampton might be examples of that. But by and large, in the key areas, which I think Dan alluded to, in areas of housing policy, in areas of health policy, in the labour market, what you see is that there is less and less power to bring about real changes. And the counter-example of that, Jonathan was talking about, is in education, where there is still, precisely because there still is the capacity on the part of a group of parents in a local community who are absolutely determined to influence the policy of that local school, they actually can bring about changes. Where is a comparable power when it comes to housing policy? How do, you know, ordinary people living in working class communities, black and white, get together in an East London borough in order to be able to change housing policy? How do they approach their local health authorities, which are a constant bureaucratic mess of reorganisation and change and budget cuts and one sort or another? Yet these are all the absolute bedrock issues. If we look for progress towards integration, these are exactly the areas where we would expect to see progress. So I think my question for the panel is, shouldn't we be consciously presenting integration, the MOOC, the demand for integration, as a democratic demand nowadays? Shouldn't we be saying that our capacity to bring about changes in the areas of equality, access to basic services, the right to make progress in your life, is a matter of rebuilding the democracy, which frankly has been battered into pieces over the space of the last 3 decades or so?
Thanks, Tom. And there was a gentleman.
I'm from the Equity Open Society Foundations, in which context I've done a lot of research about access to citizenship law, although mainly in Africa rather than in Europe. And I wonder if the panel could comment on issues around access to legal citizenship and paths to citizenship for migrants and the role that they see that playing in terms of the integration of communities and, in particular, their access to political power.
Cool. Thanks. Should we take those and then come for another round? Cynthia, just apologise, she's got to go to another meeting now. But thanks a lot, Cynthia, for your contribution. So, I guess, Karen, come to you first, the point around cultural institutions.
Culture. I mean, William Morris Gallery just won Museum of the Year, and we are doing a lot to bring culture from other countries into that gallery and get people talking about arts, crafts from other areas. We've got something called Apex Arts. We've got the Water and Forest Arts Trail, which is a really diverse group of people that get together. So I think there are real pluses in doing that. And also about civic space, as you said. Our chamber, which is, we have a very grand 1930s built town hall, which is beautiful and a very leather-clad and wood chamber. That is opened up to the community. People can come in and use that to have meetings. They can come in and have concerts. I was lucky enough about 6 weeks ago to go to a concert there that was around all Bulgarian music and culture. So we are very keen to bring people into our what is considered political space, but I don't see it as that. It's our town hall, it's our community space. And I think that, I would say that during the riots, after Mark Duggan was shot, basically we had one shop in our whole borough that was vandalised. And, you know, you've got Tottenham, which is just, you know, 5 minutes up the road from our high street. But it didn't touch us. One shot. And I think that is because we work hard to bring communities together. We've got a community cohesion group. We work hard with the police. The police works hard with the various communities. As I said, our town hall is open to everybody. And I think that it's not singling out different cultures. It's actually bringing them together. And I think as we are hugely multicultural, and I feel that we are, as a borough, enriched by that. You know, it's a really vibrant place with all, you know, you walk up our high streets and all the different food shops and clothes shops. It's a really good place to live. So I think that it is vital that we continue to do what we do. However, I did say going forward how we do that because of the budget constraints is going to be, you know, it's going to be a hard decision to make. But we still want to keep our communities tight. We also have a very we have a traveller site in our borough, so we've got quite a lot of Roma Gypsy people. And particularly in my world, and they actually get vilified more as a community, and we've actually had Roma Gypsy in my world for 150 years, but they get vilified more than any other community when people talk, and I think there's still a lot of work to be done about changing people's perception. But as long as we've got the rhetoric that we hear in the tabloids about, you know, what gypsies and Eastern Europeans and God knows what else goes on. But I think as politicians, as community groups, we all need to fight back against that. And
I was going to ask Dan first, but just about the point that Don was making, which is great there are these spaces, but do they create the kind of political change when people get a chance to meet?
I'm not so sure. I don't know, I think my personal opinion would be that you can't really have successful integration without wider social justice. So the work Runnymede published a couple of days ago on employment and the labour market and unequal access to the labour market, that's going to leave people low paid and insecure. Well, also you've got white working class communities who are poorly paid, insecure work. And that I think we did an event at Wyin Chinese Women's Society, and Sylvia there was saying if people don't have rice on the table, food on the table, they're not going to want to go and integrate because they're so worried about themselves. So I'm not sure. I think things like that are nice as well, but I think and are very useful at a local level, but I think that there has to be massive change nationally and at a sort of city level. And I think in Greater Manchester they've got these city deals, which means there's more power that they can do things with big money locally. So that might be an answer. And to integrate concerns around race, gender, migration into wider economic and social concerns as well.
I think we've got to be careful. I'm going to disagree, Karen, on this. That our view of migration sort of adopts everything that's bad and says that's got something to do with migration. I think the riots had almost nothing to do with migration. Absolutely nothing to do with migration. It was to do with a much more wider malaise than immigration. I was there in those riots. I thought it was my duty to go along. I wasn't one of those.
You had a nice TV.
I wasn't one of those riot tourists of which I saw so many going along. I thought, you know, it's my job to hold the Metropolitan Police to account. I'm going to go along and look at the riots. So I went along, and I must say, the ones I saw in Hackney are a similarly diverse borough. Nothing to do with race whatsoever. There was nothing you could say about, I mean, mostly I saw some pretty middle-class people wanting to provoke the police into a convenient snap that they could then Twitter around the blogosphere. So I don't think the riots had anything to do with migration. I think, however, one thing we've got to do, if we want, there's something that migrants have to do, and that is that the migrants themselves must engage. And if you look at some of the institutions, migrants find it very difficult when they come to a new country. It's very difficult to come out and just be part of everything. But it's a journey we've got to help them with. If you take, for example, the journey that the East London Mosque has taken over... It used to have a very isolationist agenda because it pretty much was felt vulnerable It feared, there was a little bit of fear of the community, you know, the area it was. It then, there was a radical change in there, and they switched from being quite isolationist to actually, we're going to engage with the local community. We're going to join up to the political parties. We're going to join, you know, we're actually going to get out in the community. We're going to open our doors. We're going to welcome the rest of the community in to come and see us pray. So it shows that we're not these frightening people that. And now it's a great institution, the East London Mosque. I recommend you go along there. So those organisations have got to, they've got to engage as well. And organisations like London Citizens, especially, are fantastically good at getting the most important institutions to engage amongst migrant communities. And I speak as a devout atheist, but the faith institutions, they absolutely have to. You have to engage with the faith institutions. Of migrants to ensure that they're coming forward. So there's so much more I could say.
Sorry, there'll be another opportunity. It's worth noting though that today there was a bomb scare at the East London Mosque.
Yes, there was.
And so,
yes.
Which was evacuated.
Because people don't like the way it faces out into the community.
Well, we don't know why it's happened yet, but it's worth bearing that in mind. Ratna?
This is. Just from the outside, I would say that I agree with you, Dan, that the guarantee of basic rights is the foundation of integration. So when I hear about the question about access to citizenship, without citizenship, you can't have ownership, and without ownership, you won't have engagement. So I do think that's a basic right that might, you know, that societies of immigration must pay attention to. On the issue of cultural space, you know, I'm a huge believer that public space is a great equalizer. Because everybody can meet there regardless of who they are, where they come from. We just have to imagine the use of public space differently. I gave you the example of the fire station or even a public library or a school. I mean, we've all seen those YouTube videos of railway stations in Europe being used as dance floors for flash mobs. You know, how fantastic is that? They then become, instead of a place of passing through, they become a place where people integrate. There are so many, I mean, I went for this amazing walk in London today. There are so many fantastic public spaces in this city that could be sort of reimagined as places of engagement and democracy. So I'll just stop there.
Cool. The question about citizenship, which nobody's addressed.
Well, the Mayor of London and his predecessor have committed themselves, made themselves very unpopular in their own parties for saying that we must address the problem of not just asylum seekers, but illegal immigrants and paths into citizenship. It's got to happen. It's got to happen. And you only, it's one of those issues where you only have to spend 5 minutes with it and you realise we have to normalise the status of those people who are in this country illegally. We have to do it. And it takes a London politician, it would have to be a London politician to be at the forefront of that. And I know Boris Johnson is very, very committed.
Fantastic. So,
let me just give you an example from the city of Copenhagen, where the local government declared that Copenhageners, that all migrants who live in the city of Copenhagen will be declared Copenhageners. In spite of the fact that Denmark has a regressive citizenship and integration policy, so cities again. So think about what does London citizenship mean?
There's some people who want to come in. So there's about six people who I've already got on my list. So people could be brief and similarly with the panel. So, gentlemen.
Stephen Chasho from the Three Faith Forum. We're an incubator for interfaith, intercultural programs. Actually, my question is for those on the panel from Canada, my own home and native land. The trends going on in Quebec and the effects on religious communities, the supposed, I guess, assimilation movements there. What do you respond to that? And can this really happen across the world as provinces get more power or regions get more power, move away from the national narratives?
Well done.
Thank you. Liz, you have
First of all, I'm Liz Pink from the Institute of Race Relations, and I'd just like to thank the panel because I really thought it was a very, very good everybody gave, I think, a lot of food before. Just two questions and a little short comment. And the first question follows on from the last, because Ratner, I think your presentation is very interesting, but I wonder whether actually Canada and multiculturalism is the question of the hijab and the veil becoming an issue in Canada. And I just, the second question, I wanted to thank Councillor Bellamy for mentioning the gypsies and travellers, because I think that's often overlooked at forums like this. And it's a question about the Roma, because there's more and more settled Roma now coming from the Czech Republic and from Slovakia. And this ties up with the thing about data side and evidence. What we're finding is that our government is actually not collecting data on our new populations. And because of that, we're actually not accessing EU money for the integration of the Roma. So a comment on that, a question on that. And finally, a comment about the riots, because I do think that you can't generalise about the riots. And just because there were middle-class people in Hackney doesn't mean that there weren't race issues in other parts of the countries. And I think the family of Mark Duggan actually think the shooting of Mark Duggan was in a long line of black deaths in custody and was a race issue. So I think we should be wary of generalisations.
Gentlemen, the immigration.
I'm Richard Stanton from Migration Work, which is a small NGO, not-for-profit consultancy working on immigration and integration. And until 2008, I led work for the Mayor of London on immigration and asylum policy. And so, partly, I guess I'm thinking back to that. It seems to me there's a theme emerging about agency, about people becoming active and being allowed to be active. In fact, just if I may just comment in reply to something Andrew said, the Mayor of London, in fact, I think both Mayors of London, very much emphasised the contribution that migrants made to London. And the Mayor of London, the draft that we developed was called London Enriched, and that's now published under the same title by the new Mayor. And that's sort of, I think, been the perspective. But I think what a point emerging is to say about people being active, and maybe if Karen wouldn't mind, I would refer to the example of the Irish community. Others may have heard me say before, I think the great immigration flows of the first part of the 20th century into the UK, the Jewish and Irish immigration processes, both demonstrated the pivotal importance of political engagement, really becoming politically, civically involved as a kind of a real turning point in integration in both cases. And I think the same really is emerged, and in both cases originally began in quite a defensive way, as with the example of the East London Mosque. And this connects, I think, with Don's point about the destruction of forms of democracy, democratic control over many of our major services, and how that is a blockage, really, for integration. And is there a possibility, again, it connects with the sort of thing Karen was mentioning about people who step forward in solidarity with migrant groups and want to get involved in helping them. And similarly with the Barcelona Anti-Rumours campaign, those who present this emphasise that. It's not simply that NGOs around the city of Barcelona get involved in tackling misconceptions about immigration, but in the process, they become really committed to integration. They become active participants in the process. I wonder, is there something here about enlisting, about enabling migrant groups alongside others to tackle some of these key questions about cuts, about what's happening to the health service, about the fact the education system is being broken up, so that even if people at the borough level or wider have a view about how education, how access to in education should be supported, they can't actually act on it because the schools are fragmented. Just a final point is just something from the work we've been doing in Europe. I mean, this kind of initiative, and somebody just, actually a colleague there from Institute of Race Relations just mentioned data. And we all, I think, agree that recognising the identity of migrant groups is not inconsistent with building links between them, the kind of solidarity work I was just going to refer to and others have referred to. But there is, I think, a big threat looming, and it's led especially, I have to say, by the Netherlands. But these things circulate very rapidly, even more rapidly than we can transfer good practice through our databases and so on. They circulate among national governments, which is to airbrush out migration from policy debate. I mean, we're working now with two major cities. I mean, you probably guess, but I won't mention two major cities in the Netherlands, both of which now say we don't want to talk about integration anymore. We're post-integration. Both of which now, it's only one case, I think both of them, say we don't talk about migrants anymore. And this is after publishing a major report which shows consistent, serious differentials in social and economic outcomes for the big migrant or migrant background communities. There is this trend to stop talking about migration, and I think it's dangerous. I know in the UK we've got a couple of years of good data from the census, but the risk is we'll lose track of all these issues again, because, you know, for obvious ideological reasons, people don't want to talk about it.
Thanks, Richard. Question to Simon, and then more. So, Simon.
Sure. I get worried that these debates at times, because I think that I look around the room that I see like-minded people. I think that we all agree, we're all positive about multiculturalism, and we all hold a set of values very similar, which is fine, which is great. Out there, there is a maelstrom across Europe, actually, waiting to be unleashed. In fact, in some areas, it's already unleashed in Greece and in other countries. And we haven't said a word. We, in this meeting, we haven't said one single word how we are going to confront this monster that will be unleashed upon us in the European elections. Central to the European election debate will be immigration. One way or another, UKIP, the far right group here in the UK, said that they'll win huge amounts of votes right across the country. So the question for me is this, and I think Jonathan alluded to, you know, the perception and how we deal with it, is one, how do we begin to hold the line? How do we begin to defend what we value? How do we begin to even push back? Don talked about the democratic process. What are we doing to use the democratic process, the vote, empowering black people to exercise their franchise? How are we using our media tools to use the lines, to use the information that Jonathan talked about? What are we going to do? Are we going to be lily-livered liberals who talk amongst ourselves whilst Rome is burning? Or do we use this space to plot and plan and kick back? And finally, Liz, you are right about the riots in 2011. There were key racial aspects to those riots. Let me try and articulate this well. Is that there were contributory factors to those disturbances. And if we ignore them, then we're stirring up other riots that will come down the line. There weren't the race riots of the 80s.
No.
But there were key factors. I'll say no more.
Yeah. And the final.
Okay, Matthew Rates from British Future. Just two very questions to be succinct. Firstly, to Andrew, talking about the problem with politicians making statements the empirical evidence for migration is clear that we shouldn't be worried about it as a country. What do you think would affect Theresa May or David Cameron standing up and saying that would actually be? And just a panel question to the panel, which I've already asked in one setting this week, to Chris Bryant, the Shadow Immigration Minister. Vince Cable, about a week ago, at the Lib Dem conference, said that he believed that British public opinion on migration is absolutely toxic. Do you agree with that?
If I may, I absolutely agree. I mean, all the parties have got a problem. I mean, Chris Bryant, on that famous day when he sort of rewrote his press release as he was speaking, I mean, the whole reaction to it was on basically an anti. It started as an anti-immigrant press release. My own party, they they think there's votes in speaking up against immigrants. It's, you know, and whereas conservative, you know, members of my party, African members of my party, were outraged by those lorries going round with, or the vans going round saying, because it wasn't so much that he said, one that was made to me by one of our Nigerian members was he said, it's not, obviously the message was, if people are out staying, they're welcome, should go home, that's fine. But why drive them outside my house? You know, which is, why choose the route that they did? You might just as well, he said, you might just as well choose, send vans around Surrey saying, why don't you pay all your taxes? Because that's where, I mean, that would be equally focused. You know, it's a battle we've got to have in all the parties. We're all being cowardly about the immigration issue. We're being in all the parties. We're saying, actually, the British public have got a point. No, they haven't. Actually, it's prejudice. It's based upon a lack of information. And when the British public have a look at the facts, they'll realise they're actually wrong. And it also, if you say to the British public, I've had it so many times on doorsteps. They can't stand the immigrants that are moving in and taking all the houses. And I say, what? You mean like your next door neighbour? Oh, no, not Ali. He's all right. I mean, it's the others. It's the other ones. Oh, the Turkish car up the road. Oh, no, he's fine. It's the ones further up. And if you notice, for instance, there will never be... we had threats, for example, of the BNP in Barking and Dagenham, a borough I've just moved into, incidentally. The BNP almost won control of that council a few years back. They'll never do it again. They'll never do it again. One, because the BNP only gets seats in areas which are close to where there's a lot of immigration. It's actually not where there is a lot of immigration. Because when the British public actually experience immigration, they realise, you know, it's not so bad after all. Actually, it is good. It is. And may I say one last appeal? Because it hasn't been mentioned yet, and I wanted you to say it, and nobody has. It's about, it was covered a little earlier. It's about the expectations of about education. That is the most important thing. And I want everybody to go round to Mossbourne Academy in Hackney, which is an area which would be a sink estate, normally thought of as a sink estate. And you go round that school, and you realise that right in front of you, lives are being changed and history is being rewritten. Outcomes are being rewritten. Because none of those kids at that school, irrespective of their immigration status, get an easier ride. None of them who go to that school, there's no he's an immigrant kid, we'll take it easy for them. That is never used as an excuse. The expectations are high, and those kids coming out of Mossbourne Academy are the ones who are going to rewrite the story of migrants in this country. And it's because they're through the education system. That's just an invite. Mossbourne Academy. Okay. Go there.
Jonathan, can I just ask a question about data and retreat from data? Yeah. I know that Richard and Liz talked about about whether government is retreating from data, whether for example, not counting the Roma effectively.
That was how give long and boring evidence about the census and so on at some point as a parliamentary committee. But, you know, I mean, to be fair to the government, I don't think there's any intention on the part of the government to retreat from the long and proud tradition we have in this country of being pretty good about our social science research data. And David Willetts is actually absolutely brilliant on it. So we can always do better, but I'm not too worried about that. I think there is something about, you know, it's quite, Andrew didn't quite answer Matthew's question about what would happen if David Cameron and Theresa May stood up and said things, because Matthew knows the answer, which is unfortunately, and certainly this is what I suspect David Cameron would tell you if you asked him. We'd say, well, if I stood up and told the country, you know, immigration's great, you know, we know everything my economist tells me that the population would think another fucking liar politician. They wouldn't believe him. Any more than they believe me when I get up. I'm not a politician, but I do go on television quite a lot and I do say these things. And probably the vast majority of the population don't believe me. But I do think that doesn't mean for me retreating from the facts or not saying the facts as they are. It clearly doesn't. I would, for anybody who hasn't seen it, I suspect most people in this room have seen Holly McNeish's video which is called Mathematics, but isn't actually mathematics, it's economics. And it is, the reason that I like it is not because it's a spoken word, 2.5 minute poem about immigration. But the reason I like it is not because it's funny and clever and emotional, which it is, all of those things, but because it does actually get the economics right. It is a proper, economically rigorous explanation by somebody who I'm fairly sure has an economic training of the lump of labour fallacy. And what Holly McNeish, is it?
Yes.
McNeish. Of the lump of labour fallacy and why actually... when you have immigrants, yes, they take jobs, but they also create jobs, and overall, it's probably, on the whole, the same number of jobs for the rest of us, but more prosperity for all of us. And it is a good, properly founded on economic principles explanation of why that's the case. It's had about 1.2 million hits on YouTube so far, the last time I looked, which is a lot more than anything I've ever done has. I do think that there's a lot more that one could do in that way. We, Nisa, produced earlier this week a video on a completely different subject that we're doing research on, which is on the economics of Scottish independence, which is an animation. But it is an animation of one of our research papers, of a very complicated technical research paper turned into an animation that's designed not to appeal necessarily to everybody, but at least to an intelligent GCSE student. I recommend it. You should watch it if you're interested in whether Scotland should be independent, what currency they would use. Our next project, I hope, will be to do something similar on immigration. And I don't accept we'll get a million hits, but maybe we'll get 100,000 school kids watching it, and that will be something worth doing. So I think there is... there are things we don't have to either say, well, we've just got to beat the public over the head with statistics until they succumb to rationality. That ain't going to work. But equally, we don't have to retreat and say, oh no, the public are all a bunch of, the Vince Cable, the public are just toxic and there's nothing we can do. There is somewhere in between.
Sorry, so how do we respond to the challenge from Simon that this is a nice conversation that we have amongst friends? I know there are colleagues here from around the rest of Europe who might also want to contribute. I know the chair of ENR is here as well. Dan, do you think it's just a...
No, I think in terms of politics, I've talked about your research now, but the research by Operation Black Vote on the importance of BME voters in constituencies is one aspect that needs to be done more about. The other as well is, going back to Don's point, over the last 30 years, a lot of working class communities have seen jobs go and not come back. They've seen inequality rise, and they're disillusioned. But then you've got a whole range of young people who have no idea, or they're not interested, and that then provides a potential for populist parties to come in, or someone charismatic to say, what you're thinking, that's right, that's fine, that's legitimate that you have these thoughts, and that could then provide someone even worse, perhaps, than UKIP. So I think there needs to be a lot of things done in the communities. First of all, to get the BME voters to have that impact. Also to really engage young people in the political process, because if they're not, then Manchester Central constituency had a by-election and it was a 10% turnout, which is the worst since the Second World War. And I don't know how many. So there's all these young people, but also a lot of people not voting, and then that provides more space for extremism.
It's not strictly about migration, but just yesterday the BBC One, Radio One Newsbeat published a poll which said 28% of young people would prefer Muslims not to be in this country. I think we have to recognise the scale.
I mean, on the positive side, though, I wouldn't make this point because somebody mentioned the hijab. We had a week ago a concerted attempt by a few politicians and a few newspapers to say, we must have a debate in this country about the hijab. And they made a big push, and what was the response of the country to being told we must have a debate? It was, for frankly, I think, you know, was to sort of shrug most of the country shrugged its collective shoulders and said, yeah, actually, you know, what's on the other side? Can we watch Scraping Come Dancing or something? You know, this is not a central, you know, whatever you think, it's not a central problem. And actually, the British public today has reasonably good sense on this.
Trying to cover for a little one,
thank you. I'm from Germany, from a foundation called Bertelsmann Stiftung. My name is Claudia Walter in Cities of Migration Network. Listening to your very interesting debate, and a lot of points sound very familiar to me. So I will not mention everything. Just one point, one short comment to what Jonathan Portes said at the beginning. Thank you for underlining the relevance of education system. Is not only a migration question, but an question of inclusive education. But I want to make one remark when you said London is the capital, goes mostly down or does not has the biggest difference. I could replace the word London through Berlin and other capitals as well. So this is
what were you saying? I didn't understand that. Berlin what?
You said like something like London is the capital where the difference between migrant people, students in the education system and others
now,
is so big.
I said London was the only capital in the world which outperforms the rest of the country.
Well, you could replace London through Berlin.
What, Berlin's school results are better than Germany as a whole? Don't believe it. Berlin, you know, most capitals have concentrations of deprivation. They don't do very well.
Oh.
That's true of Berlin.
Doing very badly. So maybe I misunderstood your point. Okay, sorry. But what I want to say just the most issues are so similar, although the situation is very different, of course. But therefore, we were inspired, for example, by this Toronto District School Board model, what at the beginning Alan Broadbent mentioned, and a lot of things also from education lead or also good practice from UK, and so that is one point what I think it's important to learn from each other.
Good.
Very
much.
I wanted to come back because a gentleman over there was talking about people that come from ethnic minorities that come from politicised backgrounds, obviously coming from Irish immigrants that come from quite a politicised background, and politics were talked about around the dinner table quite often. I think it's vitally important that political parties tap into that, because we actively, I'm a Labour Party councillor, we actively seek to make sure that we represent the colours of our community right across the borough. And I think that's very important for all political parties to do that. I don't care what colour the political party is, it is their responsibility to do that. You were talking about, you know, UKIP and what we're going to do. I think there is a pushback. We've got to have a pushback. We recently have had quite a lot of interest from the EDL. They came in and they demonstrated and they've been threatening to come back to us. We actually went for a judicial review to ban them from demonstrating in our borough. And it was only, I think, the second time that had been done, and we won. And we are quite clear as a borough. As I said, it's a very close-knit borough. You will go round, although it's urban, you will go round, and because people are tightly together, it almost has a village feel, and people from outside have said that it's a really good place to be. We are clear that we are not going to be dictated to by any fascist or racist that wants to come to our borough, and I think that's the sort of thing. And we got quite a lot of feedback from people that you wouldn't imagine that said, this is a, you know, you've done really well. And I think that if the EDL keep pushing, we're just going to keep pushing back. But there is, I think, a threat. And I think you're right to say that what as we, as some people would say, willing-minded Liberals going to do about it out on the street. And I think that as a borough, we've done that.
Cool. Thank you very much. Sorry, go on, please.
I feel compelled to say at least, you know, one or two points as the chair of the European Network Against Racism, which is a Europe-wide network of anti-racist organizations across Europe, and obviously the points that Simon made really resonate with me, and I think they're really very two quick observations. First of all, what we are seeing across that membership is the urgency that you mentioned. The problem that we have is the level of violence which we're now facing, that migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and ethnic minorities face, and that's, you know, that's a challenge that needs to be addressed. You know, as you say, outside of this room, because we're facing, you know, daily struggle to actually tackle violence directed towards these people, as we've seen in Greece recently. And the second point is relating to the European elections, and obviously, as Dan mentioned, the problem is the apathy and the fact that we're not very successful. We've not been successful in making the European elections important enough for people to go out and vote. And that is something, and obviously this is one of the reasons why extreme right parties managed, or far right parties managed so well in the European elections. So there really needs to be that push, not just at local and, you know, regional elections or national elections, but we need to make that message and pass that message across that it's really important to go and vote for these European elections.
Thanks, Sarah. There was one more point there. I crave indulgence, so we'll go to 5 minutes past it.
Okay, thank you. My name is Mekonnen Miskana, Heinrich Böll Foundation in Germany, in Berlin. Berlin was briefly mentioned, and it's more complicated than it has been discussed here, because Germany has a very federal educational system. It's not centralized like in many other European countries. So, very complicated, just... We'll leave it there. Just one quick remark, because we're talking about inclusive communities and societies, and I think language is part of that, and I'm not very familiar with the word gypsy, how we use it, in which context here, but it may seem in Germany very offensive, so that's the official terminology we use is Sinti and Roma, so I just leave it there, because I'm not very familiar here, but that's just quick remark. The other one is, on the issue of political participation. We're talking about inclusion, inclusive society, and I think the issue of power and power sharing, and the issue of democracy has been mentioned here, is one very relevant issue in that context when we talk about inclusion. How do we secure the political participation of minorities and immigrants in the political process? We conducted in Germany a very detailed research in 77 German cities about the inclusion of minorities and immigrants in the cities' parliaments, the degree of participation and representation. And I can tell you the findings are devastating. We expected that anyway, but we need empirical materials. So I'm very much and I'm very keen to know about the situation in the UK. How is the degree of representation in those powerhouses in the parliaments? How is that here in the UK?
Can I direct you to Simon, who will know the story particularly well? It's not good enough, I think is probably our kind of short response. Mm. I'm conscious of time, so I want to wind things up. I know there were a couple of questions about Canada. I'll just give the panel a chance to say a final word after mine. I suppose what I've taken from this, and it's been such a rich conversation and really great to see such a wealth of expertise in this room, is the importance of learning from each other, to looking up every now and again and looking around. Because I know we do sometimes get very stuck into our own policies and our own civic situations. I think there's some really important lessons to learn from all sorts of spaces, and just sometimes the hope that there's a different kind of possibility that can come out of people's will to change. I really take on board the particular challenge about communicating beyond this room and how we do that more effectively with those people who are at best antipathetic, and those who might be actually against some of the things viscerally that have been talked about in this room. And I'm hopeful that we might be able to reframe discussions about integration as progressive, as about creating the kind of change and social justice that we require, rather than something which is assimilative and somehow backwards looking. That would for me be a really great set of outcomes from these conversations. These conversations will continue. We will share a podcast of these discussions online, so we can encourage other people to engage with some of the ideas here as well. I should also mention that very regularly this afternoon people have brought up the issue of context, and something that Runnymede focuses on, hopefully relentlessly, and as well as incrementally, is addressing racism. And earlier this week we launched a campaign called End Racism This Generation, which I would encourage you all to go onto the end-racism.org website and have a look at. And what we're asking people to do is pledge to do something where they are to address racism, so we can get this back up the agenda and get people talking about it, not just on the national level, but very much at the local level in people's workplaces, communities, at the schools and other places. And hopefully that's given people on the panel a chance to think of their final comment. Andrew, let me start with you.
When organisations like the BNP have Jewish members and the EDL have Caribbean members, it makes you realise that hatred is a very shifting thing. It's a particular political cowardice in order to get votes that means that you blame whoever is the most vulnerable in society at that time. At the moment, we blame the Polish people, we blame Muslims. But it doesn't stop the fact that it's the wrong kind of thought processes that bring us to the point of hating a particular part of our community. It was interesting the question you said earlier about political participation. The parties have got to work hard to engage and make themselves available to immigrant communities. We have got to show ourselves to be welcoming. We have got to show ourselves to be inclusive. And we'll only do that when, in our terminology, we stop talking about immigrant communities as them and start talking about immigrant communities as us, because that's what they are.
Well, I would say that, as I said earlier, that we as a party reach out to, and the local authority reach out right across the board, and we are very, if you like, navel gazing to see that we are making sure that all the different communities are represented on a lot of the boards that we've got, voluntary sector and the local authority, but particularly I think politically. If you are, as I am, a politician, I think that it's vitally important that we do reach out to our BME community, because that they need to have a much bigger voice than they've got at the moment. We have a large influx of Eastern European people into Waltham Forest, and we are actively now doing stuff with them because obviously their hands are represented, they're fairly new. And we need to make sure that there is as much representation as possible for them. And I think our job as politicians is not to talk about it, it's actually to get out there and do it.
I guess saying it's from the Open Society Foundation's office, just to say that we felt really lucky to be researchers on the At Home in Europe project. And I think having open and frank discussions about wider social issues, which include immigration, is pretty vital across communities, because if people can't air their grievances, which might be difficult to hear at times, then they're just going to become bottled up and they'll be sort of taken on by someone who legitimates what they say with more sort of far-right tendencies. So yeah, I think just it's important to have open discussions about it and perhaps not judge people straight away, because actually what we found is like, people might start off with that, but when you peel it all away, it's about wider social issues that then cut across all race, all gender.
Thanks. John?
Very briefly, I agree with what both politicians just said, but more broadly, I'm still basically optimistic. Sometimes making this argument is like beating your head against a brick wall, but most of the most of the abuse I get online or in emails or whatever is frankly from people who feel resentful, as Dan quite rightly said, more than racist, and they're resentful because they think that actually history or economics or politics is in the long run on my side, not theirs, and I think they're right.
Well, my big takeaway from this is an observation that one actually makes again and again, but it's been reinforced today, that there's a real gap between the evidence and the narrative on the street, as our councillor outlined. And this is not something that is unique to the UK. It's an international phenomena. And so I just think that being relentlessly optimistic to some extent without being naive, and putting out the examples of the school system in London that does, and why does it do well, the stories about your council is something we need to continue to do, so that that feeling of resentment, and I really like that, it's not racism, but possibly resentment, that that resentment gets turned around into what we would like to call is, and what Open Society also calls, shared prosperity.
Thank you. There are some thanks to share as well. So, for Open Society Foundations for the use of their office, but also for their support in putting this event together, in particular, Ellen, Nazia and Simon for welcoming us. For colleagues at Barrow Cadbury Trust, Sarah and Claire, thanks a lot for your help and support in getting this together. For those who've come probably the furthest from Maitrey, particularly Kim, and thanks Alan for your words at the start. And to my colleagues at Runnymede, to Florence and Ed and Zalaki, who's been tweeting away furiously, thanks again for all your support. So there's an opportunity now to have a conversation and some canapés and a drink. So let's thank you, obviously, for your contribution, but also our panel, Andrew, Dan, Rattler, Jonathan, Karen and Cynthia in absence. Thank you very much.